Well, we learned this week that Chris Hemsworth and his film mates won't now be recording their next big pick in Australia due to the lockdowns. They're off to Slovakia instead, it would seem. But some other big names are returning, one of whom is joining me now, Nick Bryant, one of the BBC's most respected foreign correspondents, who's about to emerge from quarantine virtually as we speak with his family in Sydney, having made the big decision to come home, well, to his wife, Fleur's home, anyway, to relocate from the big zoo in New York to a smaller one. And what's more, to leave his professional home for just on the last 40 years, the BBC. How Nick and his family will emerge blinking into the light is something I was very keen to capture, and I spoke to him just as they were packing up in their particular little unit. And I welcomed him to Saturday Extra.
Geraldine, it's lovely to join you. I've never been compared to Chris Hemsworth before, and I don't expect it to ever happen again either.
Well, look, actually, it's quite a moment I'm talking to you because you've just been given the formal sort of stamp of approval, have you not?
Yeah, just as we were coming on air, literally a knock at the door. There's a doctor there in full PPE. There's a member of the New South Wales Police. And there's a soldier dressed in full camouflage fatigues. And what they were doing, actually, was just taking our temperature for the last time. We've already had 3 PCR tests while we've been in quarantine. We're on day 13 right now of the 14. And they were giving us our certificates. And they also gave us these like orange wristbands. It looks like we're just about to go to some sort of festival, which obviously we won't be doing for some time to come. But they're given these wristbands. And that is proof that we have done our quarantine and that we're going to be let out in about 24 hours' time.
Has it been okay? Vaguely bearable?
Oh, look, I mean, we really have been in 5-star detention. I mean, we've had a nice suite. It's got a beautiful view that overlooks the western suburbs of Sydney. We can see out to the Blue Mountains. We've had the most spectacular late winter sunsets. And look, you know, any time you think you're being dealt a bit of a bad hand, I mean, you've just got to watch what's happening in Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. And we have had it lucky.
And look, it's just this week you formally, it was your last day at the BBC. So it sounds like one of those huge life's turning point decisions for you, Nick, leaving the Beeb and deciding to, is it to settle here in Australia? I mean, can you isolate the moment when that epiphany occurred? Is that possible?
Do you know what, Jeremy? I can actually. It was the night of the inauguration of Joe Biden. I'd covered that inauguration just as I'd been on the inaugural platform 4 years earlier when Donald Trump gave that extraordinary inaugural address talking about American carnage. And Washington just felt like Baghdad. I mean, you know, even the terminology of the Green Zone, which was the zone where the inauguration took place under such massive security. I mean, they built this iron fence around the Capitol. They brought in troops. Washington looked like a garrison town. And the troops were on the streets to prevent American fighting American. And I remember getting on the train that night and returning from Washington to my home in New York. And I just thought I'd done my dash. This just seemed like the perfect time to go. I'd written a book. It was called When America Stops Being Great. It had spoken about the kind of prehistory of Donald Trump and how America had got to this point of disunion. And it just felt like the closing of a chapter. And we'd always wanted to raise the kids in Australia. They've got emus and kangaroos on their passports. We always regarded this as the sort of lifestyle superpower of the world. It doesn't feel like that right now, but it will again. There's light at the end of this COVID tunnel. We know that from our experience in New York City. And so we always wanted to come back here. And so in the end, it was a fairly easy and emotionally uncomplicated decision.
So you both got pretty ill with COVID, didn't you, last year? In fact, Fleur was pregnant with your daughter. How much do you now think that might have influenced you? Because that was a terribly challenging time in New York.
It was a really difficult time. It just felt like the headlines were closing in on us. COVID comes to America. COVID comes to the outer boroughs of New York. COVID comes to our neighbourhood. COVID comes to our building. And then we got COVID ourselves. And Fleur was really badly affected by it. I had it fairly badly, but a doctor friend said to Fleur, you should really go to hospital. But this was a time in New York, Geraldine, where ambulance drivers were literally saying to people, do not get in my ambulance if you can avoid it in any way. So we decided to just wait another hour, and Fleur's breathing ease, we had an oxygen meter which suggested that her oxygen levels were okay and she didn't require immediate hospitalization. And over the coming hours, you know, the situation got better. But yeah, this came in the late stages of her pregnancy, and the birth was dramatic. We decided to have a home birth because there were so many restrictions on partners in New York hospitals. You just couldn't stay there that long after the birth. But on the night that Fleur went into labor, it was the middle of the George Floyd protests, and they were literally unfolding outside of our windows. We lived in a place called Dumbo with the Brooklyn Bridge and Manhattan Bridge either side, and these really became focal points for the protests. And on the night that Fleur went into labor, literally there were New York Police Department helicopters flying overhead. Our midwife system was stopped from coming in our apartment building because the police asked her about why she was breaking curfew. And it was a very dramatic thing. I mean, it really did feel like something out of the Year of Living Dangerously. But of course, that's what 2020 was.
Well, yes. I mean, it must have been a small agony for you to realize that the answer to that question, is this where I want to raise my children, was no, given your decades-long love affair with the US.
Yeah, I really do love America. It's been a deep love affair that really began when I was a kid. I mean, even before I stepped foot in America, I think my mind had migrated to America long before that. And I went to America at this extraordinary moment for the first time. I was 16. It was the eve of the Los Angeles Olympics. And I got to experience, Jerry, this extraordinary American summertime of resurgence. After the long national nightmare of Vietnam, Watergate, the Iranian hostage crisis, America got its mojo back in that gold rush. Remember, they've won virtually every single medal because of the Soviet boycott, it seemed. And I was just so struck with the America that I lived in had become unrecognizable from the America I fell in love with. It was in such a state of disunion, a state of cold civil war, really. Such a polarized nation. And I just didn't think that was a particularly healthy place to raise the kids, and nor did my wife. And I think that underscored our decision to come back home to Australia.
So when you hear the Chinese leaders say America and the West, they go on to say, is in decline and the East is rising, I mean, do you think, is that the verdict you've been left with?
I think America faces huge challenges. I mean, ironically, you know, Joe Biden is actually supposedly reading my book at the moment. We saw When America Stopped Being Great on the shelf behind him in the Oval Office. And unfortunately, the events of the last few weeks seem to have underscored the thesis, which is America is in decline. It can't project its power in the way that it once did. And I think the problem really lies at home. You have this deeply divided country where the fault lines are so angry, and the divisions are just so hard to bridge. And I just don't see how America comes together. I mean, there was a view, I think a mistaken view, that Donald Trump was an aberration, that he was some kind of historical accident. But what I argue in the book is that he was almost historically inescapable. And that was underscored, wasn't it, by the results of the 2020 election. You know, more than 70 million people clicked on the terms of the Trump presidency. And it just showed how deeply divided the country had become.
You know, that pivotal event of January the 6th, for someone like you who just so loved America, I mean, that must have been an agony.
It really was agonising to watch. And of course, it raised this question, would this be the moment that the conservative movement repudiated Donald Trump? And of course, it wasn't. What it was followed by was a purge of the Republican Party of people who'd been critical of Donald Trump. And that very night, you know, almost half the Republican lawmakers returned to the chamber in Capitol Hill that was under attack and voted to overturn the election. So rather than being a moment of Trumpian repudiation, it became yet another moment of Republican radicalization. It became an accelerant of polarization. And that's such a big problem in America right now, Geraldine. These moments like 9/11, these moments like COVID, you think maybe these will be unifying moments. They ended up being accelerants of polarization.
Mm. Well, can people still have friendships or even associations? Let's not even necessarily go to friendship, but just associations with each other if they're from opposite sides of the political divide. Can you see it these days?
I think that's really worrying. I mean, you hear a lot of stories right now about families who don't get together around the Thanksgiving table anymore in November because, you know, they end up having these huge rows about politics because politics is so polarized at the moment. And I heard one instance. It was an old professor friend of mine from South Carolina, a Democrat who decided he would try and get together with Republican professors in the faculty. And what they realized over time was that their meetings were just not worthwhile because they could not find any points of common agreement. And I think, again, that underscored to me just how deep the divisions are right now, whether they're racial, whether it's on the question of abortion, whether it's even on the question of whether Donald Trump won the election or not, whether it's on the question of whether to wear a mask, whether it's on the question of whether to get vaccinated. You know, constantly we're just faced by these issues in America which reveal these deep divisions within the country.
Well, you see, you say that it's very interesting. You're a Bristol boy, and you felt that in the UK, in effect, your fate was settled, you know, in terms of your potential, whereas the American dream just promised so much, like a sort of shining star. I mean, who might articulate an American dream that reaches beyond these divides? Can you see anybody trying?
Yeah, I think this is a real problem. I mean, one of the first things that struck me after leaving Australia, 8 years ago and going to report on America, was so few Americans seem to believe anymore that their kids would lead more abundant lives than they did. And that is the essence of the American dream. The American dream, when I went there as a 16-year-old, was so vivid and so real. People looked to the future with so much optimism and confidence. They just thought their standard of living was just going to keep on improving year after year after year. And in many instances, it did. But even back in the 80s, we saw the beginnings of this broken economy, an economy that was really sort of benefiting the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and really not benefiting the people left behind. And I think the broken politics is a product of that broken economy. And when Donald Trump said the American dream is dead, millions of Americans absolutely agreed.
You go on further, though, to say that it's the way the elites of the East Coast treat him. People feel by proxy, you know, the Rust Belt people say that's how they treat us. So this is a sort of what is it? It's like a cultural divide. And I just wonder again whether you can, given that we've got this big September the 11th anniversary coming up, I mean, what are they going to do with themselves in terms of trying to reach beyond this?
I think Donald Trump was a paradox in so many ways, wasn't he? This sort of billionaire from New York who became this working class hero in the Rust Belt. And I think, you know, Donald Trump presented himself as a fellow victim of elite sneering. And I think that's why it partly explained there was this massive visceral connection between Donald Trump, who in many ways had blue collar sensibilities despite his wealth, and the people who ended up being his most diehard supporters. You know, there are a large number of people in America, many of them, you know, white working class people who feel they've been sort of besieged, really, by an America that has left them behind. And again, it underscores and accelerates this sense of polarization that exists right now.
Is it, I wonder, akin to what a lot of Brits went through with the gradual, some would say it's still happening, realisation that the British Empire had gone? Is it when you're not the dominant force anymore, it's hard for a lot of citizens who've never actually imagined themselves necessarily as part of that, it's hard for them to sort of take on board because it's a reconfiguration of their own identity?
Well, when Donald Trump spoke about making America great again, I think it really resonated with a lot of people who'd seen how America had struggled in the war in Iraq, Americans who'd seen how America had struggled in the war in Afghanistan. They'd seen their standards of living decline. I mean, one of the brilliant pieces of genius that Donald Trump came up with was never really saying when America was great. So people could conjure up kingdoms of the mind and fall back on this kind of nostalgic nationalism. You know, for some it was the 50s before African Americans were given a full menu of rights. For some it was in 1970s before automation started killing off all the jobs in the Rust Belt. For some it was the 1990s when America just seemed to be the hyper superpower of the world and nobody could challenge it. But obviously that situation has changed with the rise of China, with the falling standards of living, with a falling life expectancy even, which is obviously a sign of national malaise. And so when Donald Trump said, I'm going to make America great again, I think there were a lot of people who just jumped on board because they really thought that America was in a state of decline.
That there's magic that can be worked. Look, so you're back here now, back into the area that, as you say, is this lovely, like the superpower of lifestyle. But as increasingly, you say, no longer a journalistic backwater. This is the area where it's all happening. I wonder what Australian dream you'd like your kids to be drawn to. It's obviously very different to that American dream that so captivated you, but I wonder how you're thinking about this now.
I've always loved the egalitarianism of Australia, Geraldine. I love the fact that Australians make fun of each other and don't take themselves super seriously. I love the lack of snobbery. I love the sense of possibility here. As you said, I grew up in Britain, a Britain I think that was so class-ridden that for many people, especially from backgrounds like mine, upward mobility and opportunity just wasn't a given. And I sense that here more. People don't judge you in the same way in Australia when you open your mouth. They don't try and socially locate you in the same way. There isn't the sort of vestiges of the class system in Australia that there are in my homeland. You know, I adored living here. Like you say, I mean, I just came to regard it as this lifestyle superpower. It's just this wonderful place. And I mean, you know, we're all aware that Australia's got lots of problems that are still unresolved. But I always love living here, and that was one of the things that drew us back. This quality of life, this sense of possibility, this sense that I've always loved Aussies, to be honest. And I'm surrounded with them at work, of course, because virtually every cameraman in the BBC is an Australian. but, you know, that again, you know, fed this decision to want to be here to raise the kids.
There was a very nice piece by Damien Kaye from the New York Times Australian Bureau, who wrote a lovely, he's written a book, and he wrote a lovely piece about an Australian's attitude to risk. Say you see in the Nippers, you know, putting his children into surfing and just, he had to quell his, what he said is his American sort of standing by the edge of the wave thinking, oh my goodness, it's going to grab him. And then everybody emerging, you know, a bit tousled, but fabulous. And he really had sort of come to reflect on how much more open he was with his children than in the US. Does that ring true at all to you?
I'm so delighted that Damien of the New York Times came here and fell in love with it in the same way that I did. It's just fantastic. And it's great to see news organisations like the New York Times and the Washington Post establishing permanent presences here, because it speaks of Australia's growing centrality to this big geopolitical story right now, which is obviously focused in the Pacific rather than in the Atlantic, as it has been for so much of the time since the war. You know, my own experience of that, I mean, talking about risk and the kids, I mean, one of the things that we were very aware of there was gun violence. I mean, we didn't sort of cower in our apartment. We didn't hear the sound of gunfire. But during our 7 years in America, there were 77 shootings within a mile of where we lived, and 25 of them were fatal shootings. And we always said that once the kids realized why they were doing these actor shooter drills, which they do in American schools, they sort of hide in cupboards and pull down the blinds of their classroom doors and things like that, that would be the moment that we would go. And we did reach that moment. The kids did realize what they were doing. And, you know, again, that was another factor in the decision.
Mm. What are you going to do here?
Well, I'm going to take a bit of a rest. I'm certainly in need of that. But I'm also looking forward to some new projects. And I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do after, you know, a career in journalism where I was so blessed to cover America, which is what I wanted to do. I went to a lot of conflict zones. I covered a lot of disasters. You know, I really
did cover Afghanistan, by the way?
I did, yeah. I was our South Asia correspondent for 3 years. So, you know, I spent
quite a lot of time. So you must be watching this last couple of weeks pretty hard.
Yeah, exactly. I've been watching friends trying to get out, desperate to get out. And actually, you know, one of the projects that I'm doing, I mean, we speak about that. I've hooked up with the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas, which I think has done some brilliant work. We're going to be doing a podcast. It's called Journo. And our first episode is all about that. This generation of Afghan journalists that I knew who have been fleeing the country and looking at, you know, how a local journalist is going to cover their country under the Taliban, how a foreign correspondent's going to cover the country under the Taliban. What are we to make of Taliban 2.0 and their desperate attempt to sort of revamp their media image?
Yes, I read today an estimate that only 1 in 5 of female journalists in Afghanistan are continuing to work.
Yeah, Gerald, I mean, I think the point to make is when we were watching those planes taking off from Hamid Karzai Airport in Kabul, so many journalists and so many female journalists especially were on them. You know, you've just had this massive exodus of journalistic talent. I mean, for the past 10 years, Afghans have got used to seeing women presenting the news, women reporting on the streets. And, you know, is that going to happen in any meaningful way anymore? It's really worrying to see. I mean, a guy that I knew, a dear friend, who was a fixer for the BBC for years, a legend in Afghan media circles, a guy called Bilal Sawari. He loves Afghanistan like nobody I know, but he was on one of those planes as well. And we've spoken to him in the first episode, and he has a very sort of moving and worrying story to tell.
Yeah, it's very difficult to to watch. So Journo comes out soon, does it? It'll be available for people, because I know that people will ask me.
Yeah, we're going to hope to get the first episode on this coming week. So go to the JNI website, you know, look at your podcast app. It's been a strange thing to put together because the team that's done it has never actually been in the same room. I think we've got around that. And I think what we've pulled together tells a really dramatic and meaningful story in a really sort of compelling way. And, you know, I hope people will give it a listen, and I hope people will learn something from it, as I did putting it together, and I hope people will enjoy it as well.
Well, welcome back, and no doubt we will speak several times in the months and years to come. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, Nick.
It's my pleasure, Geraldine.
Nick Bryant, formerly the New York correspondent there for the BBC, and keep an eye out for that new podcast with the Judith Nielsen Institute called Journo. His books, two of them that I'd like to cite, When America Stopped Being Great, and The Rise and Fall of Australia, they're both Penguin Random House. And just before we get thinking of suggestions, one of our listeners suggested that the two-part BBC documentary Afghanistan, The Great Game by Rory Stewart, a former UK politician and soldier, is well worth watching. It's on YouTube. It actually, it was broadcast date was 2012. But the listener says it just gives a very good grounding of why we are where we are today.